This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. The United States said on Wednesday it would supply Ukraine with dozens of tanks after Germany made a similar announcement, moves hailed by Kyiv as a potential turning point in its battle to repel Russia's invasion. Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom reports.
The U.S. changed course on Wednesday and announced it would send 31 of its most advanced battle tanks to Ukraine, helping to break a global stalemate on the weapons that Ukraine says are desperately needed to fight off Russian forces and potentially reclaim occupied territory in the east and south. The U.S. decision to deliver M1 Abrams tanks helped resolve a diplomatic logjam with Germany, which was hesitant to send the advanced weaponry amid deep reluctance given its Nazi past.
Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Wednesday the key to supplying tanks for Ukraine's war effort was speed and sufficient numbers. In his nightly video address, Zelensky also said he had spoken to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and called for supplies of long-range missiles and aircraft. Iran imposed sanctions Wednesday on 34 individuals and entities from the European Union and Britain in reaction to similar measures they have taken over Tehran's response to months-long protests. Tehran's move comes 2 days after the EU and Britain slapped another round of sanctions on the Islamic Republic, which has been rocked by protests since the September 16th death of Mahsa Amini. Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian Kurd, died in custody after being arrested for allegedly breaching the country's dress code for women. This is VOA News. Thousands of Peruvians took to the streets of Lima on Wednesday to protest against President Dina Boluarte amid the worst wave of protest in at least two decades in the Andean country. Protesters are demanding the resignation of Boluarte, early new elections, the shutdown of the Congress, and a new constitution. The protests began in December when the then president, Pedro Castillo, was ousted. More than 50 people have been killed as a result of the unrest. Hundreds of supporters of South Africa's opposition protested Wednesday over ongoing power cuts that are crippling the African continent's most developed economy. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa has been mired in an energy crisis for more than a decade, but it has accelerated this year, with the country experiencing daily scheduled blackouts, sometimes for as long as 10 hours a day. Known here as load shedding, the cuts are meant to reduce power on the strained grid. Eskom, the cash-strapped and debt-ridden state power utility, is beset by aging coal plants that are prone to breakdowns. Hundreds of protesters massed outside the headquarters of the ruling African National Congress Party, blaming the government for failing to get the energy crisis under control. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Donald Trump is reinstated to Facebook after a two-year ban. The AP's Lisa Dwyer has more.
Facebook's parent Meta is reinstating former President Donald Trump's personal account after a two-year suspension following the January 6, 2021 insurrection on Capitol Hill. Trump was suspended the next day. The company said in a blog post that it is adding new guardrails to ensure there are no repeat offenders who violate its policy. Other social media companies also kicked Trump off their platforms. Banned from mainstream social media, Trump has been relying on his own much smaller site, Truth Social, which he launched after being blocked from Twitter. Recently, Trump was reinstated on Twitter after Elon Musk took over the company. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Two senior UN leaders said Wednesday they were pressing the Taliban to reverse its restrictions on Afghan women, particularly a ban on working in aid delivery, with one official warning that, quote, famine is looming during the harsh winter. Speaking in New York, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said she pushed pretty hard on women's issues during a visit last week to Afghanistan and said sometimes, quote, the reaction wasn't pleasant. Find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Monday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden approves dozens of U.S. battle tanks to Ukraine despite Russia's threat.
President Joe Biden said the battalion of tanks, he termed the most capable in the world, will come with the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain the armored fighting vehicles on the battlefield.
The UN paints a gloomy picture of the global economic outlook.
It says the COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, surging inflation, and the climate emergency, among other crises, are setting back short-term growth prospects.
And Pope Francis visits the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan next week. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden announced Wednesday that the United States will send 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine to counter an expected fresh Russian offensive in the coming months. This story from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
Reversing an earlier stance not to send in the immediate future such weaponry to the Ukrainians, President Joe Biden said the battalion of tanks, he termed the most capable in the world, will come with the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain the armored fighting vehicles on the battlefield.
These tanks are further evidence of our enduring, unflagging commitment to Ukraine and our confidence in the skill of the Ukrainian forces.
Biden spoke at the White House just hours after Germany announced it is sending two battalions of Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. That decision followed weeks of diplomatic pressure on Berlin. An advisor to Ukraine's president tells VOA News that Kiev will eventually need between 250 and 400 tanks, and its next request from the West will be for extended-range missiles. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Steve. And President Joe Biden's approval of Abrams tanks to Ukraine came after weeks of high-level discussions within the administration and consultation with allies. For more on what led to the Pentagon's reversal of its earlier position not to send the top-of-the-line tanks to Kyiv, I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon.
What's changed is the way that the war on the ground has evolved in Ukraine with the Russian troops and what they're seeing on the ground in terms of Russian preparations for what they expect to be an offensive as the weather warms up, as springtime in Ukraine approaches. And so what U.S. officials are saying is they're seeing the preparations that Russia is going to attack. They are going to go on the offensive. And the areas in which they're going to attack, areas in parts of the Donbas, you're talking about clear ground, open territory, which puts weapon systems like armored vehicles and tanks at a premium. So they said looking at that, it became evidence to them, along with discussions with allies and with Ukrainian officials themselves, that Ukraine really does need more tanks and they need to get them starting soon so that they can prepare to push back against Russia in this anticipated offensive. Now, the way this worked out over the last several days in discussions between the U.S. and Germany especially, both some short-term and some long-term thinking. They said that there's a need to get tanks there more quickly. So in addition to some of the Russian-made tanks that have been provided and for which efforts are ongoing, what's come to the core, the tanks being offered by Britain, the Challenger 2 tanks, and then now German-made Leopard 2s. And the big holdup there was Germany was not comfortable at first offering these tanks either directly or initially approving other countries which had the German-made Leopard 2s to give them. So the deal that was worked out between the U.S. and Germany is Germany would allow for other countries to send Ukraine German-made Leopard 2s. Germany decided to go ahead and give Ukraine 14 of its own Leopard 2 tanks, and those tanks will arrive over the next weeks and months, and training is getting underway.
The most optimistic observer, the most optimistic analyst prior to the president's announcement, was hoping that if the U.S. eventually decides to send some tanks to Ukraine, they're talking of single figures. But the president announced almost three dozen Abrams 1 tanks to Ukraine. Is this number significant? Why so much?
They want to make sure that they're setting up Ukraine for success on the battlefield. And so what officials have said is what you're seeing from the Germans and other European allies that have the German-made Leopard 2 tanks is they want to make sure that they give Ukraine enough tanks to form two tank battalions. So we're talking about roughly 60 tanks, about 30 tanks per battalion. And so that's going to be the first tranche, the first step in this effort to better arm Ukraine with armored firepower. The second part would be the Abrams tanks. And so the reason they chose 31 is that they want to have the 30 to form the core of a full Ukrainian tank battalion. And then, of course, the 31 is because the way it was explained today is that you have one tank that's kind of in the command and control node of a battalion. And so that's how you get to that number. Again, these are not tanks, though, that are coming directly out of U.S. stockpiles. These are tanks that the U.S. will have to go out and acquire from other countries that have them, refurbish them, and then supply to Ukraine. The interesting thing, though, of course, is that U.S. officials say training for this, both for tank crews and for the maintenance crews, because the maintenance of M1 Abrams tanks is complex, that's going to get underway shortly.
That's VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The war in Ukraine has exposed Europe's energy dependency on Russia and is spurring the development of new, cleaner-burning biofuels. Spain is emerging as a leader in this effort, with the introduction last year of airplane fuel made from olive pits. Marcos Hurton narrates this report from Alfonso Bieto in Seville.
At the World Economic Forum in Davos last week, Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, said that there is no time to waste in transitioning to a clean energy economy.
In less than 3 decades, we want to reach net zero. In less than 3 decades, we have to reach net zero.
The aviation industry is often cast as a villain in the fight against climate change. The International Civil Aviation Organization says that by the mid-2030s, no fewer than 200,000 flights per day are expected all over the world. Greener fuel is the only way for airlines to meet global carbon emission targets. An initiative in Spain is tapping into organic waste from olive pits to make sustainable aviation fuel. In a pilot project with biofuel maker Cepsa, 200 flights from 6 different airlines using 4.5% biofuels derived from olive pits and other vegetable waste made commercial flights from the Seville airport in late November. Research is underway to come up with similar fuels for cars that will require no significant changes in automotive technology, allowing the fuel to power vehicles already on the roads today. Fossil fuels used in Spain are almost entirely of foreign origin, which means the incentive to develop biomass technology is great. The prospect of converting olive waste into fuel and other products, such as construction materials, could boost the economy and also create new jobs in a region of the EU with one of the highest rates of unemployment. For Alfonso Beato in Seville, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
UN economies presented a gloomy and uncertain outlook for the coming year, with the gloomy economy projected to grow at a particularly sluggish rate. This as they released the 2023 World Economic Situation and Prospects Report. Lisa Schlein has the details from Geneva.
Multiple crises have converged to batter the world economy. The UN report cites a series of multiple and severe shocks for unleashing one of the lowest global economic outputs in recent decades. It says the COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, surging inflation, and the climate emergency, among other crises, are setting back short-term growth prospects and threatening to undermine longer-term sustainable development in the poorer countries. The report projects world output growth to drop from an estimated 3% in 2022 to 1.9% in 2023. Ingo Pitelli is senior economist at the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs. He says private consumption and investment are expected to weaken in most countries due to declining income and higher interest rates. He notes several countries will see a mild recession before growth is expected to pick up in the next half of this year into 2024.
The economic trajectory this year and next year will significantly driven by trends in inflation and the monetary and fiscal policy responses. The good news is that energy, food, and fertilizer prices have already come down considerably from their peaks in the middle of last year. However, food insecurity remains an immense global challenge. The number of people facing acute food security has more than doubled since 2019.
The report finds weaker economic growth in the United States, the European Union, and other developed economies last year has adversely impacted the rest of the global economy. Petrelli says most developing regions are expected to experience lower growth this year. The main exception, he says, is East Asia, due largely to the rebound in China.
Let me also point out that our growth outlook for Africa is relatively moderate. But when we factor in still very high population growth, 4% annual growth is not enough to address the region's massive development challenges.
The report calls on governments to avoid fiscal austerity measures to get out of their economic doldrums. This, it says, would stifle growth and disproportionately affect the most vulnerable groups, set back progress in gender equality, and stymie development prospects. It recommends reallocating public expenditure through direct policy interventions that will create jobs and reinvigorate growth. It says strategic public investments in education, health, new technologies, and climate change mitigation and adaptation can bring about large social and economic returns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in Zambia, the second stop in a three-country swing, where she assured the country's president and its finance minister that the timely restructuring of Zambia's debt is a top priority. She spent most of Tuesday highlighting long-term measures to mitigate the sort of threats to food and security exposed by Russia's war in Ukraine. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen spent most of her visit to Zambia Tuesday talking about the agricultural investment potential of African nations, especially as Russia's invasion of Ukraine has affected hunger and the cost of food worldwide. In a village in Changwe, an hour from the capital Lusaka, Yellen emphasized not only tackling acute food needs, but also scaling up investment in food system resilience for the long term. Speaking to a group of mostly female farmers participating in the U.S.-backed Green Climate Fund for small-scale agriculture operations, the Treasury Secretary also voiced support of including Africa more in global food fertilizer markets and supply chains. On Monday, she met with Zambia's president and its finance minister, whom she assured that restructuring of the country's debt was a priority for the United States. Zambia was the first African country to default on its foreign debt, estimated at about $17 billion, during the COVID pandemic. The country has asked for help through the Group of 20's so-called common framework, but implementation has been slow, with the U.S. accusing China of slowing down the process. But Yellen said she was encouraged after meeting last week with the Chinese vice premier in Switzerland.
Let me say, I know that the Chinese have been a barrier to concluding the negotiations. I specifically raised the issue of Zambia and asked for their cooperation in trying to reach a speedy resolution.
China's foreign minister, who recently visited five African countries, has rejected claims that China has not been committed to helping Africa ease its debt burden, insisting his country is an active participant in the G20 debt service suspension initiative. Before Zambia, Yellen visited Senegal, where she met with Senegalese President Macky Sall, his finance minister, and other officials. She also spent time at a business incubator with women entrepreneurs. Yellen will wrap up her tour with a visit on Wednesday to South Africa, where Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had talks on Monday with his South African counterpart, Naledi Pandor. Russia is pushing to strengthen ties with an historical ally amid the war in Ukraine. South Africa was among several African nations in the United Nations General Assembly that abstained from a vote calling for Russia to be suspended from the Human Rights Council. Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
It was a wake-up call to the United States, the vote that took place in April of last year, where the United States tried to rally the world to condemn the Russian invasion, and it really fell short, specifically on the African continent. And I think it was a reminder that if you want to be the leader of the free world, you have to try to lead that world. And if people aren't willing to follow the call for democracy and liberty, then you have real worries on your hands.
Next on the list of U.S. cabinet members to visit Africa is U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who plans to travel to Ghana, Mozambique, and Kenya starting Wednesday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
In other news, the UN envoy to Haiti says the country's police will not win a fight against criminal gangs without more international support, including the key deployment of a rapid action force. While it has been 3 months since the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres proposed such a force after it was requested by Haiti's government, diplomats say discussions appear to be stuck on which country would take the lead. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Pope Francis will visit the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan next week. The pontiff will visit the DRC from January 31st to February 3rd and then spend 2 days in South Sudan before returning to the Vatican. His visit to the two African countries had originally been scheduled for the summer of 2022 but had to be postponed due to ill health issues. VOA's Ruben Kiyama spoke with Father John Joseph Mbikoyezu, the coordinator of the South Sudan Catholic Bishops' Conference, who is familiar with the papal visit to South Sudan. He began by explaining the significance of the Pope's visit to the world's youngest nation.
This visit is very significant for us, the South Sudanese and the region, because we can see in the tour that the Holy Father is doing. First of all, he's coming to DRC, a country which we know is experiencing also political turmoil, a country which is suffering from so many problems, economically, wars, insecurity, displacements, and so on. So coming to South Sudan is also showing that there is much suffering in this country for years, even after its independence. So its significance for us is really based on the fact of peace. There is a lack of peace and security for the people in this country. The Holy Father and the other two church leaders, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the moderator of the Church of Presbyterian based in Scotland, their appeal for peace has been very significant, and this was demonstrated when the South Sudanese president and his vice presidents visited Rome for retreat. The Pope appealed openly for peace among themselves and peace for the people of this country. So we know that the visit of the Holy Father will help to bring stability, will be able to bring security, because this visit is bringing awareness to the region and also the international community to extend their hands for peace and security in the country.
Briefly, tell us how the Pope's program will look like while in South Sudan.
The program for the visit of the Holy Father is very significant for us. On the first day, on Saturday, he will arrive around 3 o'clock. He will be received at Juba International Airport. And after a while, then he will go to the presidential palace, where he will meet the president, the vice president, and then the representatives of the civil society, the diplomatic corps, and the other representatives. The following day, the Holy Father himself will talk to the bishops and the priests, religious and the seminarians at the St. Teresa Cathedral in Juba in the morning hours at 9. And then in the afternoon, he will have a meeting in communion with the other church leaders accompanying him with internally displaced persons. And they will share their experiences of their lives in the RDP camps. And then the Holy Father, the Archbishop Canterbury, and the moderator, they will give a message of encouragement to them and to us all who are at this situation now in our country. This will be followed at 6 o'clock with ecumenical prayers, which will be held at Dr. John Garang Mausoleum, where everybody is expected to be, a prayer that unites all of us.
That's Father John Joseph Mbikoyezu, the coordinator of the Sudan Catholic Bishops' Conference, speaking from the South Sudanese capital, Juba, with VOA's Ruben Kiyama.
In the quest for a better life abroad, many unsuspecting women are sooner than later hit with a bitter reality, being held in bondage by recruiters or so-called employers in lands far away from their homes. On the next edition of Our Voices, we'll ask, what are African countries doing to fight against this crime? And what can women seeking employment do to ensure they don't fall into traffickers' traps? Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Africa. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is wrapping up her trip to Senegal, Zambia, and South Africa, and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, heads to Ghana, Mozambique, and Kenya. We talk with Africa experts about the significance and impact of President Biden's energized U.S.-Africa policy. Next on Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The black granite pedestal of the Holocaust Memorial in Baltimore is inscribed with George Santayana's most famous aphorism: "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." That is why January 27th, the date on which the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration and death camp complex was liberated in 1945, is observed as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The Holocaust was the result of Nazi Germany's final solution to what they called the Jewish problem, the systematic attempted annihilation of European Jewry. It was separate from the Nazi war effort. Indeed, the final solution often took precedence over the war effort. Despite a desperate need for personnel and material on the front lines, no assets were diverted from death camp assignments. In the end, the final solution resulted in the murder of 6 million Jews. Today, as the terrible events of the Second World War retreat from living memory, in many countries, denial and distortion of the Holocaust are on the rise. It seems incredible that more than 75 years after the end of World War II and the Holocaust, people still deny and distort the facts of the genocide, one of the best documented mass atrocities in human history, said Ellen Germain, Special Envoy for Holocaust Issues at the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. We have mountains of evidence, extensive survivor testimonies, and eyewitness accounts from those who liberated the concentration and death camps. Yet, Holocaust denial and distortion persist. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance says that Holocaust denial seeks to erase the history of the Holocaust. In doing so, it seeks to legitimize Nazism and anti-Semitism. Holocaust distortion acknowledges aspects of the Holocaust as factual. It nevertheless excuses, minimizes, or misrepresents the Holocaust in a variety of ways and through various media. Countering Holocaust denial and distortion matters because all efforts to downplay or blur the facts of what happened and who was complicit are insults to the victims and survivors of the Holocaust. It matters because it further perpetuates anti-Semitism. It matters because it also can fan the flames of violent extremism, said Special Envoy Germain. Countering Holocaust denial and distortion matters because they threaten our ability to understand and learn from the history of the Holocaust, she said. Never again is one of the most important moral lessons the world can draw from the Holocaust.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.